Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address-based wormhole. I'm Ed Horley. I'm here with my co-host Tom Coffey and Scott Hogue. And today we're going to talk about Wireshark and IPv6. And we're very lucky to be joined by Jeff Carroll, who's with HPE. We've known Jeff for a long time, done a lot of community work with him. And we wanted to talk to him about his work around IPv6 as a network instructor, as a person who's given sessions at Interop, and as a teacher, I think, day-to-day around what he does with IPv6. So, Jeff, I wanted to welcome you to the IPv6 Buzz and, give us a quick summary of a little bit about yourself so folks get a little bit more than maybe what I gave them, and then we'll dive straight into some interesting questions around Wireshark.
Well, great. Well, thanks, guys, for inviting me out here today and talk about, I would say, two of my favorite topics, IPv6 and Wireshark. So I've been in networking a long time, like most everybody else here. Been in V6 probably a little bit shorter amount of time than you very much seasoned V6ers. I've only been doing V6 for about 8.5 years.
So short period of time.
Well, hey, in relative terms, yeah.
Well, let's dive straight into it. Let's talk about that, because 8 years is as far as I'm concerned, is a long time to be working on V6. But you've been working on Wireshark, I think, even longer than that. And I think the first set of questions that we had was really like, do you think today, given what's going on in the industry and sort of the understanding around IPv6, do you think packet level understanding of IPv6 is actually something that network engineers really need to have as a skill?
I don't know that I would say that they really have to learn. I think what it allows for is a better, might not even be the right word, a clearer understanding of what or how IPv6 works. Because even though there's a fair number of parallels between V6 and V4, and so you can take a lot of your V4 knowledge and morph it and understand V6, there's a lot of other differences. I almost view it as like, well, 50% of V6 has parallels to V4, but there's a whole bunch of things about V6 that don't. And to talk about it, to see it in slides, to kind of see, I would say, generic outputs of operation, don't always, I think, make it as clear as looking at the packets. I think it kind of also depends on your general usage of packet decoding. And not that you've got to get super deep into it, but I think it sometimes makes a lot of difference as to what you are seeing.
Well, Jeff, this is Tom, and I think I can. I just wouldn't want to add to that for me, like the scales really fell from my eyes the first time that I did a packet decode of the neighbor discovery process. Like when I think about there isn't really a parallel for that on IPv4, and just sort of as you were talking about seeing the process on say a PowerPoint slide, and really I know what the codes are, and I know what the packets are supposed to look like, but until I actually dug into the packets with Wireshark, it wasn't super clear to me like what the process actually looked like, and there was a great deal of clarity that came from viewing neighbor discovery at the packet level that really reinforced what I'd sort of learned in a classroom setting.
Well, absolutely. It was the same thing for me. When I first started working, I would say in detail with IPv6, I was working on a course update. And yeah, okay, this is how V6 works. And yeah, I look at some, IP configs, IF config outputs. Okay, yeah, got addresses, pinging, things work. And it wasn't until about a year later that I was working on a co-authoring book project. And it's like, okay, well, now I need to kind of understand it a little bit better. And like you say, the neighbor discovery protocol and functions are largely newer to us with V6. And it's like, well, wait a minute, how come, Windows is acting this way and macOS is operating that way and Linux, oh, wait, well, this version of Linux doesn't even support it. Wait, and you get the different things, and it's like, the end result, they seem to be okay, but the getting there is sometimes a lot different.
Well, it's like the other one that makes you scratch your head is like suddenly your Wireshark output's like, why is it all just listing multicast all over the place? It's like, why do I have all this multicast appearing on the screen and being tagged out that way versus I'm just used to seeing unicast all over? It's probably a big change for a lot of people too, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Display filters. So you probably have to help them a lot with display filters to filter through. Although I think Wireshark does a pretty good job out of the gate on its own, just sort of helping people understand what's happening there, right?
Well, two interesting comments there, and I'll take them in the order you listed. So display filters, I am an extremely heavy user of display filters, it kind of in all aspects, but even more with IPv6, because especially with V6 and some of the different components in there, I want to look at some of those, just those packets, you know, very specific packets. I don't want all the rest of what I would call noise going on and flying past where I can't find it. The other component that is just even, you know, a slight difference in Wireshark with display filters and color filters as well, or coloring rules as referred to, is that ICMP and ICMP V6 are the same color in default Wireshark color rules. And while that may be okay, if I'm looking at all protocol traffic, I can't distinguish my V4 and my V6 ICMP, and there's tons of it. And so, okay, fine, I can use the display filter ICMP V6 just by itself and see that traffic. But again, if I'm looking for other things, sometimes even comparing the V4 and the V6, you know, traffic functions. Now I want to, in addition to having a display filter maybe help in that view, I also want to go change a color filter and create a color filter specifically for ICMP V6 so that I can more easily distinguish that. I think that's what really propels that little bit of learning, is seeing traffic in that kind of a mode, whether it's, you know, color or shades of gray, or, you know, just something that has a little bit of a distinguishing difference to it.
The way I see use Wireshark is, I mean, as you're starting to roll out IPv6, you may have only a small amount of IPv6 packets. So you're looking for an IPv6 needle in a haystack of IPv4. And so if you only care about IPv6 packets, having a V6 capture filter helps. Then you can do a display filter saying, I want to look for ICMP V6 type 134 routing advertisement because I want to look at the options. Then you use a display filter to look at that particular ICMP V6 message type. You know, so you could use both in combination, cull down on the vast amount of V4 haystack you don't care about, focus in on exactly what you need to troubleshoot.
Also true. I mean, it's just like I say, in that kind of dual stack world, there's a lot of traffic that you just don't care about, and not even V4. I mean, sometimes it's just what I call the low lying protocol stuff, you know, just the layer two protocol stuff that's flying around, you know, spanning tree packets and some of the other broadcast type traffic that's going on. It's like, okay, we just continually work on that filtering process to assist in that viewing.
We don't talk about Ethernet on this show, so.
Ethernet, what's that?
What's that?
So we can make a distinction here between, I think, you know, like what we talked about at the beginning, which is using Wireshark to really help understand the protocol a little better, knowing that, you know, there's some substantial differences between what we're used to in IPv4, but then actually using it in the troubleshooting process and the way in which we're sort of refining the results to drill down on whatever the issue is. But on that subject, I mean, what are some of the issues that you've encountered? Or I guess if maybe there's one particular issue in V6 that seems to rise to the top, you know, more than the others. And you touched a little bit on sort of the differences in how neighbor discovery works between the different operating systems. But if you're actually out there having to troubleshoot V6 in the wild, are there sort of themes that you're seeing over and over again, behavior that, you know, maybe somebody out there that's listening might help them in their whatever their network environment is in making sure it's working right?
Well, I can't say that I've got a lot of exposure to that, to a lot of, you know, in the wild, but probably the things that I've heard are kind of a twofold. One, it's the getting it up and going correctly, as it were, and then the you know, okay, now it's kind of operating, but we're seeing some weird things or some anomalies going on that we can't quite explain. And so one of the things that I kind of stress to folks is, like, you need to not only quote, you know, lab it up and start understanding just how it basically works and what you think you're going to need as a foundation configuration, but run Wireshark then as well. One of my big things about Wireshark is how many people have traces of the good days, of the good times, of the application in its working prime, so that when they now have to go troubleshoot, they have something to compare to. You know, like Scott said, you know, you got the needle in the haystack. When we're troubleshooting, we're looking for something that doesn't look right if we don't really know what's going on, if we don't know what's right. And most of the time, people don't raise their hand. No, I don't have traces of the good times. Things are working. Why would I go get a trace? I got other things to do. And to me, it's kind of like that great network diagram that we all have. About the time we printed it, it was accurate, right?
That's right.
And about the time you print it, you go, oh, there's one more thing. And it's kind of like, okay, things are working. We're pinging and applications are happening and functioning. Next, you know, we're onto pulling the next ticket and going off to the next little project. And it's like, no. You should understand why it works, especially core applications in an infrastructure. And then it gets some traces. So that's your reference shelf that you can go look to and try to do even some of those kind of compares. And those understandings of why, like, client-level operating systems react differently with V6 than they do with V4, especially with the things like, you know, privacy addresses and the temporary addresses and the timers for some router, of those things.
For router advertisements, I'm going to call you out, Jeff, because you early on you said, oh, well, I don't have that much in the wild, and I'm like, I'm going to call BS on that one, because you did some pretty good presentation and discussion forums around sort of multiple RAs and what the impact has on operating systems and what behaviors differences between Windows and OS 10 and phones and handsets and what happens when you see multiple, you know, prefixes on a network segment coming from different routing advertisements was pretty fascinating. And some of the presentations you've given on that is pretty good. So I don't know if any of that is standardized out or if you feel like it's any better than it was before, but maybe you can give a little bit of insight into some of the things that you've seen in the past there around that behavior for operating systems, because that's pretty fascinating.
Well, you know, it is. And again, that's one of those areas that we generically don't have a parallel to draw from in V4, of the router advertisement being a required thing. I was literally reading something with probably in the last week or two, where somebody was saying, well, no, I don't want, you know, this to occur. And it was kind of the difference between getting an address via Slack or getting an address via DHCP V6, where the, you know, router advertisement has to have certain flags set for how an OS is going to get the network prefix and perhaps how it's going to get its host ID. And so they were kind of commenting, and they said, well, my favorite classic one is I turned on the, you know, the M flag, the managed flag in my RA so that I can get my DHCP V6 operation. And the statement follows with, yes, that was a good thing to do. And if you read all the manufacturer docs about any of them that are doing V6 routing, they will say, you want to do DHCP V6, the router advertisement will tell the clients to do that when the M flag is set on. What they all fail to tell you is, but you probably don't want to also do the Slack operation where the router is going to give everybody the network prefix. So you actually want to go turn off the A flag or the auto configure flag. And that one to me is the biggest glaringest oops that we have, because all of a sudden when we're turning on the M flag and we're all happy because now we're getting a DHCP6 address. And then we find out we're also got all these other addresses because the A flag was still on. And, oh, guess what? We're not using our DHCP V6 for anything because we're using one of those addresses we got via Slack, you know, the temporary address. And everybody's like, wait a minute. And even more fun is when they're doing like a client server trace in Wireshark, and they're only looking for the packets from those two addresses, and they know the DHCP V6 address for the client, they know the probably statically assigned address for the server, and they've got their Wireshark all set up, and they got the, you know, from here and here, and nothing comes through.
So we've wandered into the auto addressing labyrinth, and we're likely to be eaten by the Minotaur at this point. The folks that are listening at home, I don't know if it's possible to summarize if one of us wouldn't, and Jeff, you're a great candidate for this because you've done more documentation of this sort of activity and behavior than I think all three of us put together. But, you know, for the folks listening along at home, maybe a just a brief digression on what the auto addressing options are, just so that there's some common understanding of what we're talking about here with V6. So just like the two possibilities, does everybody know that's listening, the two, you know, so we've got Slack and we've got DHCP V6, and those are really the two choices. And then you mentioned the flags that set that, and how many flag settings are there to account for that behavior?
So yeah, and maybe just even slightly back up from that, in the design of the, at the time they were calling it next generation IP or IPNG, they were saying we want to get away from manual configuration, because at the time everything was manual. Everything was what we would call a public address, you know, 25 years ago. There was no boot P at regular, I would say, client operating systems or anything like that. So part of that was how do you build that? And part of that was, okay, well, where is a common denominator that would be the router? So, okay, we'll have the router send out a certain kind of packet. We're calling this the router advertisement. Within the router advertisement, the client OSs will pick up certain flag settings and derive how they're going to do their own addressing without any other intervention at the client operating system. So one of those is we know it's called SLAC, or stateless address auto configuration. So the router advertisement gives everybody their network prefix, the first 64 bits for the network. And then basically the other part of the flag says, derive your own host ID, your other 64 bits. And there's a couple processes for that. One we know is the modified UE64, which takes the MAC address and pads it with some extra bytes and modifies a bit and creates a unique address for the host ID. And the other one is what we call the privacy extensions, which is supposed to be a random number generator for that 64 bits. And so at that point, there was no other touch that had to be done. And with that thought in mind, again, there's no parallel in V4 for that. The other one, because of the V6 IPNG development, the V4 side started coming up with some ways to more automate things. And that's where we see the modification of boot P into DHCP and operating system supporting that functionality, where they say, basically, you know, give me an address, please. And then we can send that packet through to a DHCP server and get an address. So we have that same parallel for V6 called DHCP V6. But they also said we still want the router advertisement to be the key indicator for the client OSs. So again, we don't have to touch the OSs, and it kind of sort of doesn't even matter if they have a default state or not. It should be whatever the router advertisement tells a client OS to do, they should do. And so we have these flags that are set, and the default setting for the router advertisement is to do Slack. And so that's what we call the A flag. And that flag is set on client OSs see that flag and they say, okay, thanks for the prefix. I've got my host ID. Here's my full 128-bit address. The DHCP flag, or the for DHCP V6, the M flag, the manage flag, if that's on, the client OS should just say, okay, thank you, and send out a DHCP V6 solicit message, in this case, to basically say, DHCP V6 server, I need an address. But that one has to be turned on at the router configuration. Mm-hmm. And that's where I kind of make those comments that the manufactured documents are great to tell you to do that, but they don't even have a little side note or a parenthesis note or any big bolding flashing letters, numbers that say, turn off the A flag. And so clients end up getting, they do what they're supposed to do. And this is where I started really, I would say almost scratching my head, because I didn't quite get it, you know, because I was getting too many addresses. And you start looking at it with Wireshark and you say, okay, well, the router advertisement went, the client got an address, yes, and then the client also sent out a DHCP V6 request. It got an address, and now the client's loaded up with all these V6 addresses, and then it's which one does it use?
Yeah, I kind of affectionately refer to that as the Christmas tree RA, because all the lights are on. It's like an NMAP scan with the SYN, ACK, RESET, PURGE, URGENT, you know, all these flags set all at once.
That's awesome.
That's right.
Not heard that before.
And so the, and then this of course is terrible, like in an enterprise environment, right? I mean, it's like, you know, hey, we're using DHCP. We want to use DHCP v6. We want to get one address. We want to have that client tracked in that way. And then, you know, all of a sudden there's these other addresses. And then you mention the address selection, which is a whole nother labyrinth to wander into, right? The RFC, if you've ever browsed through the RFC to see like, what's the source address selection or what's the destination address selection? And it's quite complex, and folks aren't really used to dealing with that in V4 land at all.
Well, exactly. And even to those points as well, when I started seeing some of these operations, especially in that, in those choosing where the client can do, again, what they call the privacy extension address or the random number generator, the RFC says, okay, you're going to do two processes and we're going to call one of these a temporary address. And the temporary address should change on a periodic basis. And that's almost word for word of the RFC. Nowhere in there does it say how often that periodic change is. And so the different manufacturers use different timing algorithms in their client code, their client OSs. And that becomes another issue as well from, say, a troubleshooting viewpoint that, you know, you're looking through. Maybe, again, you're doing a point-to-point looking view, and then all of a sudden the traffic stops. Yet you look over on the screens you're sitting next to, and everything's still working. Mm-hmm. You know, well, that's because the address changed as it was supposed to, because the other thing that V6 added to it in this whole addressing operation is a very graceful, on-the-fly way of getting a new address, sunsetting out your traffic of the old address, and picking up with the new kind of all at once. And it's very graceful, very elegant. It really works, I think, very nicely. Yet in some modes, it's like, wait a minute, my address just changed. And if you're not expecting that behavior,
right?
If you're expecting, it's another one of those
consistency over time of saying, this client got this address, I expect to see it the next time I fire up Wireshark, I should see the same address, right? That's the assumption that your students would have, because that's the behavior you usually get in V4, right?
Exactly. If you do a DHCP V6 only style address, you may be closer to getting the same one. And if you do with reservations, of course you will, but you don't see that. Generally, you don't see that periodic change.
We've arrived at this point now. We've talked about the complexity of the auto address selection, the different auto addressing types. We've talked about the address selection based on source and destination. We've talked about the address timers. And so if it's not already clear to the listeners, Wireshark is going to expose all of this information to you, right? I mean, you're going to see the source and destination address. You're going to see the router flags. You're going to see the prefix included in the router advertisement. You're going to see the address lifetime, preferred and valid. So all that information is at your disposal in that Wireshark capture. And so it seems as if that's just based on that additional complexity, man. If you're not looking at the packets at that level, if you're not familiar with it at that level, it's really going to make it difficult to troubleshoot IPv6.
Absolutely. And one of those things, too, in using Wireshark is they've got the concept of profiles. And so not only have I always kind of talked about, as I got more and more used to profiles for Wireshark, say, you know, you're going to have profiles for certain applications, for certain protocol. And what that profile does is bring in your favored display filters, capture filters, color rules, and have it kind of all the buttons at your fingertips, and do the same kind of thing for V6. I've got two or three different, what I call my favorite V6 profiles. Like if I'm just doing router advertisement troubleshooting, I've got one specific profile that's got my colors and my columns and everything set, you know, the way I want. If I'm just doing generic V6 type looking and or troubleshooting, then I've got a kind of a generic profile that's got a number of different display filters, you know, already created, just named filters that I can very quickly look at my traffic, whether it's a live trace or a save trace.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you use a protocol analyzer quite a bit, and so you're familiar with the tool, and so it's ready at your fingertips, and you'll immediately be productive because you've spent time learning your tool. You know, when you go to grab your little shovel, is a simple tool or drill or something, and if you're familiar with it, you know you can grab it, rely upon it, and be instantly productive. But don't wait to be troubleshooting a V6 problem to try to figure out what your display filter should be, I guess, is what you're saying, is be proactive. Know you're going to have to do this. Spend some time in a lab getting to know IPv6, the protocol, and Wireshark, so that when you need it in an emergency, it'll be that much better of a tool for you.
Well, absolutely. I mean, even even part of that labbing, you know, prototyping, as folks are looking at, okay, yes, we're going to deploy. And so everybody has, a foundation understanding. We should do a little bit of trying this in a semi-controlled, not in the day-to-day production environment, right? Even if it's off hours on the production system, fine. And I always tell folks, start firing up Wireshark. The first thing you start doing any kind of configuration to start seeing what occurs on the wire, like those router advertisements. First time a V6 enabled interface routing interface comes up, it sends out three of these just in quick sequence, and then it sends them out on a periodic basis. But as a V6 enabled client comes online, they send out what's called the router solicitation, which is kind of like a, hey, are there any V6 routers out there that can tell me via a router advertisement what I'm supposed to do? That's the English, you know, conversion to that. But to even see those kind of operations, if people have that understanding before they've ever truly implemented that in a production mode, that helps them understand the tool, helps them understand the protocol.
Well, what's ironic is there are IPv6 packets on enterprise LAN, internal LANs, right? Because you have IPv6 enabled nodes on your LANs. I bet people would be shocked to see IPv6 packets in Ethernet 2 frames on their VLAN 100 in their data center.
Right, because they haven't deliberately enabled it, but it's still there. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I think that might be a good exercise for IT folks to do. Turn on Wireshark, put on an IPv6 display filter, look at the V6 traffic that's already on your LANs today.
Every
network segment, probably.
That's right. That's right.
Yep.
Oh, and what's more interesting to that, it's something that popped up earlier this year, one network manufacturer now has V6 enabled on their boxes. As soon as you enable an interface, V6 is already enabled. So it's already got its what we call that link local address, which has not been the behavior before at router level operating systems.
Right. Oh, that's cool.
And so I do this all the time in a V6, you know, presentation. I'll say, okay, who's running IPv6 on the network on purpose? And generally there's no hands go up. And I said, yeah, but you probably have V6 on your network. Oh, no, we haven't turned it on. And like you're saying, but it's enabled on a lot of operating systems. And I'd say the very same thing, Scott. Turn on Wireshark and don't do anything different, but maybe put in the IPv6 display filter and just look. Yep. And you'll be so surprised. And they say, oh, no, we turned it off with the tick box. We turned off the protocol in our Windows operating system. It's kind of like, yeah, kind of, sort of, no.
I don't know where you got that from.
I don't think that was mine. But, yeah, it is a big eye-opener when folks start thinking about that. There's a presentation I've done a couple times and may do a couple more, and I call it I'm in your net. And I basically come through through the internet to a public IP address on a machine, and once I'm on that machine, I get admin rights to that machine, and then I snoop the network on V6. And my comments to folks are these multifold. One, it's probably on and you don't realize it. Two, you're probably not watching for any bad guy traffic. You know, you're not looking for any recon traffic on V6 protocols. Mm-hmm. So I can sit there and snoop around all around your network on V6, run nmap, run a few other utilities, and discover what's going on. And then I can start binging away at, say, the routers, or even more fun, install my own router. Mm-hmm. In part of this demo, I install VirtualBox on this machine, and then I install like VIOS, and I configure it for V6 routing, and now all the devices on that subnet get real V6 addresses, and then I can start trying to, you know, exploit into those devices. And the eyeballs just go wide open because people are like, what? How could that be? It's because you don't really know what all is going on in your network.
Well, that's awesome. I appreciate the advice. Well, I think we're going to wrap. I mean, unlike V6, we sort of run out of space for the podcast. So Jeff, how can the audience follow you on the internet? I know you've published books, you're a published author, you're on Twitter, but Facebook websites, anything else? How can folks reach you?
Oh, pretty much Twitter. It's Jeff Carroll underscore V6, and I'm relatively active, at, you know, as best I can be during the day, which isn't much sometimes, but definitely active there. I don't do Facebook, so that's pretty much my only public way. The book Guide to TCP/IP, IPv6 and IPv4, which is actually a fifth edition, I was a co-author on, and I was brought in largely for the V6 content. And one of the things we did in that book was go into some details. There's like sample traces, little mini exercises to help folks understand it and learn it a little bit more than just reading about it.
Great. That's awesome. Well, for all of us here hosting on the IPv6 Buzz, you can reach Tom at IPv6Tom. You can reach Scott at Scott Hogue. So it's Scott Hogg. And I'm E. Horley. So it's Ed Horley. So it's just E. Horley, Ehorley, on Twitter. And with that, we wanted to thank you for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz. And I really recommend you check out all the other content over at Packet Pushers. They have some great weekly shows like Network Break, lots of other stuff that you can catch up there. So, you know, until next time, we'll see you on the internet, the IPv6 internet.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.